Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Éireann Ílana digs deep into the discovery of a rare fern in Killarney National Park. Eric Dempsey takes me to see some waders on the North Bull Island in Dublin. And Terry Flanagan pops into the Kildare Animal Foundation to get a health check on the Blessington Street swans.
Yes, Derek, I'm here in the Kildare Animal Foundation and I'm following the progress of our swans. I know I'm calling them our swans because we've been monitoring the progress of this particular family since early summer, when the mammy laid 6 eggs and the eggs hatched 6 cygnets. Now, the daddy, he disappeared very, very early on. I don't know what happened to him, but she successfully managed to look after these 6 cygnets for a number of weeks. And then, sadly, one of them died. And then a second one died. And then last week, 2 more died.
I'm really looking forward to hearing Terry's report from the Kildare Animal Foundation, because I was very concerned last week when I saw the last remaining cygnet and Mom being taken away by Lisa, one of the volunteers. Everybody was concerned. They looked very poorly indeed. And as I mentioned last week, they were taken off to the Kildare Animal Foundation wildlife section for some rest and recuperation, to be given some proper nutrition. And let's hope it has worked. Terry will tell us later on. So a busy show ahead of us today. We'll also be learning more about that fern that was discovered back in July. Ina has an interview with the man who discovered it. Happy days. But we're going to start by going to Kilcool in County Wicklow. Niall Hatch is ensconced in his home there today. Niall, how are you?
I'm very well, Derek. Nice day here today. Looking forward to the programme very much.
Good to hear it, Niall. Now, I want to start by talking about wading birds. This is a good time to see them, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the very best times, because this is when they're migrating in big numbers. Some of them are here to spend the whole winter with us, coming down from their breeding grounds in the Arctic. But at this time of year, we also get other ones that are just stopping off for a few weeks to refuel before they head even further south. So birds that would be heading down from the high Arctic, maybe down to places like Morocco or Mauritania, or even further south than that. So a very exciting time for wader watchers.
Now, just explain to people what a wader is, Niall, if you would.
So waders, it's a big group of birds that tend to be found close to water. They have long legs generally and quite long beaks, mm-hmm. and they use those to probe into the mud. And there's many different species, and most of them have different lengths of beak so that they're able to feed side by side, feeding on different items without competing with each other too much. And Ireland, given our geographical location and our rich wetlands, especially in coastal areas, we get large numbers of these, of many, many different species, dozens of different species of waders.
So they're coming here to feed. Now, why are they leaving their own home turf, so to speak?
Well, some of them do breed here with us and they wouldn't have to travel too far, or they may even be heading further south again. But most of the ones that come to us come from the Arctic, from all over the place. So they could come from northern Scandinavia, Siberia. They could be coming down even from places like Iceland, Greenland, northern Canada. And of course, in the summer when they're breeding there, it makes sense because there's 24 hours of daylight. Mm-hmm. There are very few predators who can hurt them. But then, of course, around this time of year, the situation changes drastically. The daylight almost completely disappears. And in the middle of the winter, it would be totally dark. 24 hours a day. It gets extremely cold. It's almost impossible to find food. So they have no choice but to move further south to rich wetlands where they can continue to feed. And Ireland fits the bill very nicely for them.
And pretty much anywhere around the coast of Ireland, you can get out and see waders, even in our current lockdown situation.
Oh, you can, absolutely, because there's many different species and they like different habitats. So quite close to me here, I can walk down to the beach, not too far from where I live, within my 5 kilometres, and I see birds like oyster catchers and ringed plovers on the beach. I saw some curlews flying over there the other day as well overhead. So these are all members of the wader family. You know, especially in coastal areas, people can quite easily see them. But even inland, around larger lakes, you'll see waders stopping off there to feed as well. So just keep your eyes peeled and hopefully you'll see some.
Well, I saw some the other day with Eric Dempsey at the North Bull Island. And what a day it was.
Derek, you made it.
I did.
Bit of a wet and windy
what
day.
A morning, Eric.
It's
what a morning.
Not the most pleasant. Into November now, so it's really, for me, sort of winter. Autumn ends in October for me. But we're on the Bull Island, as you know. I'm using the car here to shelter a little bit in out of the wind. I have my scope up trying to keep the rain off. And of course the Bull Island is where I cut my teeth looking at shorebirds. And you know, as I'm looking out, the tide is just coming in. And for anybody who's interested in going out to look for shorebirds or look for ducks or anything like that on a big estuary, the key is to get it on the rising tide, because the birds are forced into the last little bit of mud and they all concentrate there. And then when that piece of mud is covered over by the water, they all go onto the alder marsh and they roost. So the key time for looking for birds in a big estuary is on a rising tide. So you don't worry about the wind, you don't worry about the rain. And I'm looking out here now and I can see all of the shorebirds are just beginning to gather up into the top
you
corner.
You keep saying shorebirds. I would say waders.
Well, I would say waders. Do you know why I keep saying shorebirds?
No.
Eric? I tell you,
I'm asking you.
It's because I've been guiding Americans for so long.
Oh, I see.
And when I'm showing people, they're usually Americans and they use the word shorebird. They're shorebirds, so
I'm surprised you didn't say, how are you doing on this
yeah,
fall
how
day?
You doing? How are you? So yeah, they're shorebirds. Waders, of course, are what I really should be calling them.
Yeah,
you're
well,
right. I'm glad you picked me up on that.
Well,
no,
well,
that's good.
I felt I had to on behalf of our listener, and
yes,
there is only one.
Yeah, no, they are. They're waders. And, you know, right in front of us here, besides like the fact that we have Brent geese, which are coming back in big numbers, and there seems to be a lot of young birds with them. You can tell the young birds by the barring on the wings. And we've pintail back in, you know, shoveler, we've teal, we've widgeon.
Now, pintail, shoveler,
and they're
teal
all
and widgeon
ducks,
are all ducks.
All ducks. And, of course, the big ducks that we have out here, the shell ducks, really
they're
colourful.
Huge, aren't they?
Dark green heads and orangey breast band. And, of course, unlike a lot of the ducks that we have, the teal and the widgeon, they're all vegetarians. The shell duck is actually looking for tiny mollusks. They're searching a bit like a shorebird, like a wader, looking for the small snails and things that are at the very top layer of the mud. So they are actually not grazers, they're not dabblers in the
well,
sense of other ducks.
New every
yeah,
day.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing about shell ducks, of course, is that they nest in rabbit burrows. So they nest in burrows.
Yeah.
And for that reason, the females don't need to be camouflaged. So the males and females are equally colourful. The males are a little bit bigger and the beak is much brighter red. But both of them
because
are brightly
coloured. Because they are a colored. Fairly conspicuous bird.
They are. They are. They're a big, big bird. And they're the biggest duck that we actually have in Ireland. But of course, it's the waders that really attract me. And of course, in summer plumage, a lot of the waders are beautifully coloured. You know, our godwits are lovely, rich orange, you know, designed for camouflage up in the tundras of Iceland and places like that. And the dunlins and knots are all lovely orangey. And, you know, but in winter, of course, they're all grey. And that, of course, makes sense, because if you're a bright orange on a grey mudflat, you stand out to a predator.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
You know, so there's peregrine falcons and things always hunting out here. I'm sure if we do a good search of all the fence posts out there, there is a good chance there will be a peregrine falcon sitting on one. So they're all grey, so people get intimidated. You know, how do you begin to tell one wader from the next, because they all look grey?
Legs?
Yes, so there's three or four things to look for, right?
Because the legs are still very colourful.
Yes, size of the bird. Is it a big bird, is it a medium-sized bird, or is it a small bird? So big bird like curlews and godwits, medium-sized like the redshanks, small birds like dunlin or knot. Mm. So that's the first thing you look for. What size is it? And that gives you a sort of a group, a category to look for. What's the beak like? Is it long, is it short? Is it straight? Is it curved? Is it up-curved? Does it curve down? And as you say, leg colour. Does it have bluish-grey legs? Does it have black legs? Does it have red legs? Does it have green legs? What colour are the legs? And if you look at those three individual things
and, if you can
and combine them
all
and combine them all, you'll
you
be able to identify just every shorebird that you see, every wader that you see.
Okay.
So it's just a handful of things. And the other great thing is that waders all feed alongside each other. So you can make direct comparisons with them.
Hmm.
They're not like little warbler that's flitting around a bush that you only get a
no,
bare glimpse
like
of.
A cafe, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you can get really good views. And of course, the reason why they're all feeding alongside each other is they all have different length beaks. So the beak probes into the mud. If you have a really long beak like a curlew, you go deep into the mud. If you have a medium-sized beak like a redshank, you're going halfway into the mud. If you're a little ringed plover, which is a tiny short beak, you're just going to the top layer. So they're all able to feed alongside each other without competing directly with each other. And of course, when you're looking at them, they're all standing beside each other. So you can get size comparison, you can get beak comparison, you can get plumage comparison, you can get leg colour comparison. So I would encourage people to go out and have a look. Don't be intimidated by them.
This is the time of year to
do it. This is the time. You know, all these birds are coming in big numbers now. And it is probably the best time to start getting your eye in on them. And they're going to be here for the whole winter. And if we get a really cold winter, if we get snow, say, in Europe, we'll get thousands and thousands more of these birds coming in. And of course, when you think about the journey some of these birds have made, some of these birds, like the bar-tailed godwits, have come from places like Siberia. You know, they've undertaken incredible journeys from places like Greenland, from Canada, Northern Europe, from Siberia. These are long-distant migrants, and here they are feeding right in front of you. And they're so busy feeding, do you know what? You can almost walk up to them.
It's a lovely day, albeit wet and windy and cold and everything else that's going on around us.
But where would you want to be in a day like today?
Right here, sir.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a pleasure to show you some of the birds of the Bull Island, Eric.
Thanks again to Eric, who met me at the Bull Island the other day when he was doing a bird count. Now, Niall, a study published by Birdwatch Ireland in July 2019, that's your annual scientific journal, Irish Birds, found that the number of water birds wintering in Ireland has declined by 15% over the past 5 years.
Yes, it's very worrying, and that's part of an even longer downward trend. We know that the decline has been going on since at least the mid-1990s, and since the mid-90s, we've had a decline of 40%, and that represents 500,000 individual water birds that are now missing from this country in the winter. So it is very alarming. So although Ireland still gets large numbers of water birds visiting us, many species are in decline, and for some it's worse than others. So obviously with the waders, as we've been talking about, they're water birds, and many of those have been affected. We're seeing quite a lot of the ones that breed in the high Arctic, like knot, for example. It's a bird, K-N-O-T, mm-hmm. like a knot you would tie. That's a small wader that would often come to coastal areas. Their populations have really decreased, not just here in wintering in Ireland, but across their whole range, across Europe, Asia, and North America. So that's, you know, we don't know if that's related to climate change. It's some possibly to do with food availability. We know that some wading birds and other water birds are prone to disturbance as well. I mean, I often would see places on the coast in Ireland where people let their dogs run off the lead and run through flocks of waders.
Oh, that drives me crazy, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And in many cases, that's illegal, particularly in special protection areas. And people think that they're doing no harm with this, and people, I'm sure, don't mean any harm. But of course, the birds are terrified. They see the dog as a predator that wants to kill them, even if the dog doesn't see it that way. The waders don't know. They see a large, scary mammal running at them, or a wolf, essentially, and they panic. And if that happens to them too often, what happens is they burn up a lot of their energy, and they go through a lot of stress as well, which then means when they migrate back north to the Arctic to breed. In fact, they may be able to lay fewer eggs or maybe no eggs at all. They may be just too depleted in terms of energy and nutrition that they just don't bother breeding that year, and the population goes down and down. So that seems to be hitting them as well. But the general picture is that regardless of what type of water bird it is, if it's a duck, if it's a swan, a goose, a wader, their numbers are all declining as a group. So there's something seriously going wrong.
All right. Well, it's very sad news. But at the same time, what can we do?
Well, I think it's important to make sure that we make Ireland, especially in the winter, as welcoming a place for these water birds as we can, because we're a refuge for them. You know, we talk about birds flying south for the winter, and we usually think of them as going, you know, somewhere very warm. Well, to those birds, these water birds, Ireland is that warm place they go to. We have quite mild winters here compared to the rest of Europe. You know, the birds have access to ice-free water throughout the whole winter, generally, which is what they need. So we need to make sure they're not disturbed. We need to make sure that there's enough food for them in these areas as well. We obviously need to also work with other countries, who, you know, as we do through the BirdLife International Partnership, to conserve these birds across their whole migratory range, because Ireland can't take the whole blame for this, of course. There's problems on the breeding grounds in places like Scandinavia and in northern Russia. There's issues happening in Canada with some of our water birds as well. So there's many things that need to be looked at. But I think the most important thing is to cherish them for the natural treasures that they are, and to prioritise their protection and the protection of the sites for them, I think.
Well, if you want to learn about waders, you can go to our website, rte.ie/money. Here's a nice story you'll find interesting, Niall. It's about ferns. It was a fine morning in July, I'm told, when botanical researcher Dr. Rory Hodd set out for a pleasant stroll through Killarney National Park. Now, while walking in an especially remote and little travelled part of the park, one of Europe's few remaining fragments of temperate rainforest, he chanced upon an extremely rare find. He found a tiny tropical fern growing on mossy rocks, previously only found in the cloud forests of the Caribbean. Aina Nilana takes up the story.
I'm speaking to Dr. Rory Hodd, who is the county recorder for Kerry. And as being a county recorder myself, and indeed the secretary of the Botanical Society of the British Isles, as it was known in those days, although it's now called the Botanical Society of Britain and Ireland, I know how important it is that county recorders must actually visit their counties and find out lots about the plants that are there. So in July 2019, Rory organised a meeting of the British Bryological Society to go to Killarney and have a look at the mosses there, because bryology, of course, is the study of mosses. So in July, Rory and a crowd of merry bryological researchers all went on a trip into Killarney, and they went looking at mosses. So they walked about, I suppose, for an hour from where they left their car right into an inaccessible part of the forest there, which is, of course, a temperate rainforest. Anyone that's ever been to Killarney knows it rains a lot. And Rory, you made the most wonderful discovery. Would you like to tell us what you actually found?
Well, yes. So we were just exploring this lovely piece of woodland and going up along this stream. And I just kind of happened to look, you know, down at the surface of this rock growing beside the stream. And I saw what I thought at first was just funny looking moss. But then I looked close and said, you know, this is a fern. And it was this tiny little fern, just, you know, about 5 centimetres in length growing out of the rock. And it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. So I was like, OK, this is something new, something strange. And everybody with me was like, OK, none of us know what this is. You know, it must be something new. So we were very excited to see, OK, what exactly was this growing here?
What made you think it was a fern rather than a moss, given that it was very small, it was of the size of a moss, it was in a wet place where you might expect mosses to be? Why did you suddenly think this is a fern and not a moss?
Well, generally mosses are very thin and you know, have a certain structure, and they're usually thin, let the light through. The leaves are kind of mostly one cell thick, whereas this, you know, is really thick, kind of leathery kind of texture to it, and you know, you couldn't see any light through it. Just had the structure of a fern. And then when I looked on the underside of it, there were these little sori which hold the spores. So mosses don't have these structures. And then it was clearly, I clearly knew it was a fern then, because it had this structure that was unique to the ferns.
So your colleagues, who are all no slouches any more than yourself, none of them knew what it was. They'd never seen a fern like this. So now it was obviously something terribly rare. So what did you do? Did you photograph it? Did you take a piece of it? How did you, you know, move on from a fern that nobody knew what it was to finding out what it might be?
Well, I took a tiny piece, so the smallest piece I could take to make it possible to identify it. And, you know, well, just to say here that obviously, you know, it's not ideal to be picking things you don't know what they are. But in this case, you know, if we don't know what it is, we can't really, you know, identify it. And then you can't do anything to document it or protect it and so on. So we took a small piece, and then I sent it off to Fred Rumsey in the Natural History Museum in London, who's the expert on European ferns, to give his opinion and to identify it. You know, he's extremely excited, and he very quickly identified it as Stenogrammitis, was the name of the genus which is in. Then in conference with his colleagues in America, who are experts on these kind of ferns, then identified it as this species, Stenogrammitis myosaroides.
And this was actually a new fern to Ireland, which is very exciting. But it was also a new fern to Europe. This particular fern had never, ever been discovered in Ireland, Britain or Europe before. The only place it was ever known from before this was actually in the Caribbean, in places like Jamaica and Cuba and the Dominican Republic. So how on earth could you be possibly expected to know what it was?
That's it. Because, I mean, this whole group of ferns, it belongs to the grammatids. This is a group of ferns that the whole group doesn't even occur in Europe. So there's a couple of these species in the Azores, but not in Europe. So it's completely different, really, to anything we have. With the common polypody ferns, its closest relative, but even that is fairly distant as such.
So you said that you took the teeniest possible little bit. Was there only one plant of it? Was there only one area where it was, or what was growing around it? Can you tell us what the ecology of the area was like? Was it growing on the ground? Was it growing out of a piece of soil on a rock? Was it in a river? Describe in detail where it actually was.
It was growing kind of off the rock surface. So it'd have a network of kind of little, what they call rhizoids, like little roots that spread across the rock surface. It was growing kind of through the moss as such, but directly on the rock. And it was just kind of above the surface of the river. So there's a little stream kind of running below the rock, which is giving it humidity that it needed. On one kind of big boulder, there was about 30 plants, and with another bit of exploration down the stream a bit further down, there's another similar boulder with about another 10 plants. So it was in these two locations, and I've, you know, gone back and searched that stream and searched other streams nearby and still haven't found any more, but I'm still hopeful that, you know, it'll turn up in similar places, because there is lots of similar places, you know, in the Killarney National Park that it could easily, you know, be hiding in.
So now, how do you think it got there? I mean, did somebody from, I don't know, from Jamaica or Cuba come to live in Killarney at one point, bringing some vegetation, some tropical plant with them from that area, and these things were passengers on board? Or have you any inkling or any theory as to how this peculiar looking thing ever got to Europe, all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, not even coming down to the Azores, but making one fell swoop, one leap, if you like, from Cuba and Jamaica right across the ocean, 3,000 miles to Kerry?
First, you know, first thing we had to rule out was, OK, had someone brought this in? You know, some non-native ferns come in on tree ferns, or they're cultivated, but in this case, you know, it doesn't grow in other plants. Nobody really imports plants from that part of the world to here. And, you know, it's not, these group of ferns really hasn't proved easy to cultivate in the past. So yeah, we could say, okay, it hasn't been brought in that way. I mean, it seems extremely unlikely that it was brought in by humans. So then the other thing, which has kind of been documented in mosses and liverworts, but never in ferns per se, is that it kind of came across on the air current. So, you know, this fern has really tiny, tiny microscopic spores. You know, they're really tiny. It grows at kind of in Jamaica and Cuba and so on. It grows at high altitude in cloud forests, about 2,000 meters altitude, and so the most likely thing, although it sounds quite far fetched still, is that, you know, these spores were released into the, you know, into the air, then the air currents took it up into the, you know, higher into the atmosphere, and the winds brought it all the way across the Atlantic, which is a long way, but, you know, that's, you know, in Southwest Ireland, the main prevailing winds are from the southwest, so they'll be blowing directly from the Caribbean, and also in the jet streams, a very fast stream of air, and, you know, it's not as far-fetched as it sounds at first.
And then they just happened to fall out of it and landed in Killarney. But isn't it not much colder in Killarney than it would be in Jamaica or Cuba? I mean, did the thing not get a terrible shock when it landed in Kerry, which I'm sure is much colder than those places? Or did it really land in the kind of same habitat it had left?
It's actually surprisingly similar to the habitat, because remember that in where it grows in the Caribbean is it's quite high altitude. So, you know, it's about 2,000 metres altitude. So of course, you know, at sea level there, you know, the climate is far warmer and, you know, nothing would be able to survive. But where it grew, you know, in the cloud forest there, you know, it's probably gets quite, would, you know, definitely will get quite cold at night and so on. So similar to Irish temperatures. And then Kerry's climate, you know, similarly humid, you know, very moist all the time. And also there's very little frost. So, you know, Kerry, you know, some winters, you know, you never really get a frosty night all winter almost, and also there be insulated by the, you know, the canopy of the trees and the surrounding kind of rock walls, so get very little frost, so it's just about, you know, within its temperature tolerance.
So it came in the wind. Now, do you have any way of knowing or thinking, is it spreading? Has it only arrived last week in relative terms, or has it come thousands of years ago? Is there any way of knowing, comparing it to the species in Jamaica genetically? Are they recently separated? Are they identical? Could one breed with the other? Have there been any studies done on when it might have arrived?
Well, yeah, this is the next question, really, is because looking at the morphology of our Kerry specimen, there's some little differences, you know, from the material in Jamaica that suggests maybe, just maybe, it has been separated for a long time. But yeah, the next thing now is to look at the genetics, see, okay, how similar is it to the Caribbean material, and has it evolved in any way while it's been here? So if it is that bit different, then we could say, okay, it's been here for thousands of years, and it's just been undetected. And it's a really interesting question, but, you know, and genetic analysis may or may not give us the answers we want, but, you know, it's tantalising that it could have been here, you know, for all those thousands of years.
So what is the history of the forest area in which you found it? Has that part of the Killarney woodlands always been forested? Has it never been cleared? Is it really as much as we can imagine natural forest in Ireland to be?
it's the closest we have to natural forests. So I think that, you know, even the wildest bits of forest in Ireland have been cleared at some point and grown back. So I would say that there's always been, you know, probably been forest cover in that area. And it's maybe that area was cleared at one point, but always there would have always been forest nearby. So if this is a quite a mobile species, it could have moved from patch to patch as necessary. So hard to know exactly, you know, how long that bit of forest has been there. But, you know, it's certainly been there for, you know, it's one of the oldest bits of forest in Ireland, I would have thought.
So this is really then a wonderful discovery in Ireland's temperate rainforests. We tend to think of rainforests as being something that occurs in the tropics. You know, to describe our forests as rainforests maybe gives them more attractiveness, gives them more importance. I mean, if we have rainforests in Ireland, surely we should look after them.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, this is a unique habitat because of our, you know, really special climate, you know, with high humidity, lots of rainfall, temperatures not fluctuating too much. One of Ireland's, you know, special gems as such is this rainforest, which occurs in so few other places in Europe that we have a special responsibility to, you know, conserve this, you know, for future generations to enjoy.
So do you think they'll be looking for it in Glengariff now that Cork will want to seek and it find something in its rainforests too?
That's it, exactly, yeah, and I'm sure.
Because it was probably coincidence. I mean, if those spores are coming along on the wind and dropping out, presumably all over Ireland, I mean, it's only chance that they'll land in a place where they can actually grow. So, I mean, mightn't just be this one portion of Killarney. It might be in some other obscure patches too.
Well, that's it. It's a kind of a tantalising prospect almost. That I think that, you know, it seems likely that there's this whole, you know, almost all these spores of various things and just raining down, you know, that, and most of them just land in the wrong place where conditions aren't right and we never know any more about them. So, you know, this species could turn up somewhere else or other similar species, you know, so it's... And also, I mean, some of the species that we do have, like, the, you know, for example, the filmy ferns, the Killarney fern, you know, I wonder if they, you know, going back thousands of years, if they came in a similar way, that there was just a chance establishment of a couple of spores and then they spread from there. So it's really interesting to see what might turn up.
Well, anyway, at least it isn't evidence that there was a land bridge between Jamaica and Ireland sometime long ago. It's another way of plants to arrive naturally without actually being brought in by humans. So anyway, you're keeping your eyes peeled, as the fella says, looking out for more rare plants. And I hope you succeed in finding and publicising more of this work. Listen, it's great talking to you, Rory. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Evelyn. Lovely to talk to you too.
Thank you very much indeed, Rory and Aina. Have you ever been to the Caribbean, Niall?
I have. I've been fortunate enough to go several times to the Greater and the Lesser Antilles. I know the cloud forests of Jamaica quite well. They're wonderful for bird watching.
I've seen
the ferns there. I must admit, I'm not a fern expert, but there's very few biological similarities between the West Indies and Ireland. So the fact that this fern has been found in Killarney is absolutely remarkable. I don't think anyone could have ever guessed that would happen.
It's fantastic. Well done, Rory. You've got a keen eye, that man. He definitely has. Now, you know, we've been following the plight of a mother mute swan and her six young cygnets on Blessington Street Basin in Dublin for the last few months. Last Friday, I brought you the news that there was just one cygnet remaining and the adult female mute swan, and that the decision was made by Dublin City Council to call in the Kildare Animal Foundation Wildlife Section. And they came along, a nice volunteer called Lisa, and she caught the adult mute swan and the cygnet, put them in the back of the car and took them off to the Animal Foundation. And I gave you an update last Monday telling you that they seem to be responding very well to treatment there. And I promised a full report this week, which is exactly what we have for you now in the guise of Terry Flanagan. Terry.
Yes, Derek, I'm here in the Kildare Animal Foundation and I'm following the progress of our swans. I know I'm calling them our swans because we've been monitoring the progress of this particular family since early summer, when the mammy laid six eggs and the eggs hatched six cygnets. Now, the daddy, he disappeared very, very early on. I don't know what happened to him, but she successfully managed to look after these six cygnets for a number of weeks. And then, sadly, one of them died. And then a second one died. And then last week, two more died. So we were all very concerned about this, not only just you and I, but also Lorraine Bull, who's the Dublin City Biodiversity Officer, and I've spoken to her. And last Wednesday, she called in the Kildare Animal Foundation to remove the remaining cygnet and adult female. Now, the council had performed an autopsy on the third cygnet that died, and I believe it died from hepatitis, hepatitis being an inflammation of the liver. Now, as I said at the start, I'm here at the Kildare Animal Foundation, and I'm with Dan Donoher. Dan, can you take me through what happened after you got the call last Wednesday?
So a call came in through our helpline from Dublin City Council, and we sent out one of our volunteer wildlife responders. Lisa responded to the call, and she went out to assess the situation. Lisa's actually here today, and she'll
be... I got a chat with her.
Yeah.
Lisa, tell us, you got the call last Wednesday.
So I got the call. So I went into the Blessington Street Basin, and unfortunately one of the cygnets had been taken by a fox during the night. So we only had one cygnet and the mother swan left to rescue.
So of the initial mammy and daddy and six cygnets, we're down now to just the mammy and one cygnet.
One cygnet, yeah. The father.
In what condition were they in?
Oh, very, very poor. At this stage, the cygnets now should be similar size to an adult. But this little one was only about 3 kgs, which is half the size, definitely half the size that it should be at this time of the year. I could lift it nearly with my hand. Very weak. The mother was okay, but she seemed very, very hungry, mm-hmm. was the main concern.
Okay. Any noticeable damage or injuries to either the mother or to the young one?
No, no damage or no injuries whatsoever to either of them. Just very malnutrition, you know.
So you've taken it back here to the sanctuary, and I see you have a number of other swans as well. You're right when you talk about the cygnet. It does look a lot smaller than those other cygnets that you have here.
One I've just brought in now with me today is 6.2 kilos.
So and that's twice its weight.
And that is small. They normally at this time of the year should be between 8 and some are up to 10. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. they're similar size to adults at this stage, because now they're being chased away from their nesting area and they need to be strong mm-hmm. to survive.
Now, Dan, you've got this mammy and you've got this baby in, so to speak. What do you intend to do with them?
So we're going to look after them here for another few weeks, fatten them up. And they'd be, when Lisa picked them up, they were brought to our vets, Grey Abbey Vets in Kildare Town. And they got their initial assessment there. They were put on IV fluids.
And what was the initial assessment?
So they were quite weak. And as he said, they were hungry. So we've got them on fluids. And as it was suspected that maybe there was some kind of infection that had killed the rest of the family. So started them on antibiotics as well as the IV fluids.
Now, how are these ones doing? They've been with you now for a week or so.
Yeah, so the first few days was a bit rocky. They were quite weak, especially the cygnet, as Lisa was saying, she's only 3 kilos, so we're really worried. But the fluid seemed to pick her up, mm-hmm. and ever since they've been really well. Mammy's protecting the little cygnet, and they're eating like lots of greens and different pellets and stuff for us. So we're really happy with them so far.
Well, looking at the female here, the mammy, she looks fine and healthy. The little one, it certainly does look underweight.
Definitely very, very underweight. It's fly feathers haven't even developed yet, so that's how, you know, underdeveloped it is at this time of year. As Lisa was saying earlier, that they should be flying away from their parents. So, yeah, he will probably be with us for some time yet.
And I don't see very many white feathers on the cygnet, because I would have expected to see more, and I see more in some of the other ones that you have here. You have, what, about 6 or 8 or 10 cygnets here. They're all, you can see they're like weeks ahead of our little one.
This one, I would reckon, if I was to see it during the year, would be probably around 3 months old, I would imagine. So, but these lads are much, much older, so very much behind.
So what do you think is the problem?
I think lack of nutrition, lack of food source seems to be the issue with the cygnet anyway. And maybe because they weren't getting enough food, then they were susceptible to infections.
And would that be the same for the mother? Or was there any real need to take in the mother? I know it was taken in because it was with the cygnet.
Yeah, for our own safety, we didn't know what we were dealing with. So it was best that we took the female in as well. And also it gives comfort to the cygnet as well to have the mother close by.
Yeah, I understand that. But I was just wondering, was there any particular problem with the female?
She was really hungry. I'd noticed that when she came in. She was straight into the food, where normally swans would be taking maybe a few hours or a day to settle in and then start to eat. But she just drove right into the food.
Well, I know from where they have come, the Blessington Street Basin, because I'm very familiar with the basin. And I've been down there, as has Derek, on a number of occasions, 5 or 6 occasions during the summer. It's enclosed and it is a park. It's a little pocket park, as it's sometimes referred to. But it's really a lake full of water. In fact, it used to be used to supply Dublin City with water, drinking water. And up to, I think, 1976, it was used to make whiskey. But is it really an ideal habitat for swans? That's what I've often asked myself, because I know swans, when they're in their natural habitat, they like to feed on the edge of a river or edge of a canal and upturn and pick on algae and whatever they can get. The basin is slightly different because it has very, very deep sides.
It sounds, I haven't seen it myself, Terry, but by the sounds of it, it doesn't sound like it's ideal. I think the parents have moved on and they're, you know, they're hardy and people are feeding them and stuff, but for developing youngsters, it sounds like it's not the ideal environment and they're not getting the proper nutrition that they really should be.
Well, I think you've probably hit the nail on the head there, the proper nutrition, because I must say, the locals that are there, it's really very much a local community, and I've spoken to a number of people down there. I've spoken to people like Ben McCardle, who goes out and he feeds them daily. He feeds them on the right food. I see him bringing down greenery. There are a number of people who are feeding bread, and I just don't think that's really very good for them.
It's not. We discourage people from feeding bread. You know, lots of greens and grains and stuff are all ideal for swans and other water birds. And they're easily and cheaply bought in shops, and you can buy them even in supermarkets, the grain and stuff. So we really, if people are feeding waterfowl, we'd encourage them to feed the right foods, because as even it might not affect the adults as much, but definitely for growing young, that's when we see all the problems.
And I know Dublin City Council, they're doing great work down there, and the gardeners, they put in so much effort, not only into the park, but into the wildlife there. There's lots of different ducks and that there. They've also got signs up, please don't feed bread to the swans or to the ducks.
Yeah, and that's fantastic, and really it's good for people to be encouraged, but I just think for developing young, it might be an issue.
So going forward, do you see the basin as being a problem habitat for the likes of the swans?
I think so. I think for as I said, for adults it seems to be fine, but for growing youngsters it seems to be an issue. And I'm not sure how people could address that. We don't want to be interfering with nature either. So that's something that needs to be considered.
Well, that's a really interesting question. You don't want to interfere with nature, but if you have next year a pair of swans come along and they try to set up a nest here, should we interfere?
I don't think so. I suppose there's a fine line between helping wildlife that are in trouble and then interfering with them. And I wouldn't... Firstly, it's illegal to disturb nesting birds, but I wouldn't be a fan of...
Is it illegal if you're going in to try and help them?
It is. You would need a licence from National Parks and Wildlife Service and have a really good reason to why you needed to remove a nest or to disturb a nest.
Well, this could be a good reason.
Possibly, yeah, and it's something maybe we could discuss with the council and national parks.
You said earlier on too that these two swans were brought to the local vet. Are the vets good? In other words, will they look after these wild animals before they bring them on to you?
There's different veterinary clinics around that will help wildlife, but when I started doing the work that we do, I found it really hard to find a vet that would help. But over the years, through awareness and working together, that we have been able to get more vets on board, but we definitely need more vets to help. It would just be a vet taking in an animal, either to be put to sleep if it's suffering, or maybe just give it initial first aid, fluids, pain relief and an assessment, and then we would take the animals from them. But we definitely need more vets to help wildlife in their area.
Well, I remember as a young fellow, going back to when I was about 8 or 10 years of age, and any time I would find any wild animal, like the gulls that I see around here or the jackdaws, that I used to bring them down to my local vet. He's long dead now. Paddy McDermott was his name. But he was an incredible man for looking after wildlife. And what I was always impressed with, they never charged you for looking after wildlife.
Yeah, I said... People, I think they don't know much about wildlife, so sometimes vets are scared to take in wildlife, or maybe that to be left with the patient then to look after, and they don't have the facilities to do that. But that's where we would come in on board. So if they were able to do the initial veterinary side of it, then we would take them on for rehabilitation. So
you could work together?
Yeah, a good partnership. And if we can't help, if it's in a different part of the country, we would maybe recommend a local rehabber to take that animal on board. So as I said before, you know, people wouldn't be left with that animal, so we would be able to help and have a good partnership then.
Right, well, getting back to our two swans here now, they've been in here, they've settled in. How long do you see them staying here, and what is going to happen to them?
We're going to feed them up now for the next few weeks and months. I reckon they'll probably be here until early next year, judging by the cygnet, because it really needs to have its flight feathers grown before we can release it. The mother is nearly going to be fit, I'd say, in the next few weeks, but if they have such a close bond, it would be a shame to split them up just yet.
So you let the two of them go together?
Yeah, that'll be ideal. We'll either bring them back to the basin if we feel that's the correct thing to do, or we'll find a new habitat for them.
So in the meantime, it's fatten them up.
That's it, fatten them up, plenty of food.
Thank you, Terry and Dan and everybody at the Kildare Animal Foundation for all the work you do 24/7 on a voluntary basis. We really do appreciate it. We would be lost, and so would the animals be lost without you. So we take our hats off to you. Now, Terry was in touch with Dublin City Council. Lorraine Bull is the biodiversity officer with the council, and she has asked if we can mention that if anyone spots a swan that they think might be in difficulty or look undernourished, to contact their local authority or the National Parks and Wildlife Service. And we're happy to do that. Now, Niall, let's move on. Can you describe a gannet for me, please?
Oh, yes. The gannet, one of my favourite seabirds and Ireland's largest breeding seabird. They're very large white birds. They have a wingspan of 6 feet. So that's enormous. And then the pure white all over, except for the tips of their wings, which are black. And then they have a lovely sort of lemon yellow, very subtly yellow head. So, and they dive plunging into the water to catch fish from a great height. It's very impressive indeed.
Thank you, Niall. Why did I do that? Well, it appears that reproduction rates among northern gannets were hit by 60% at one of the country's beauty spots because of people taking selfies. Research by a student of the Environmental Research Institute at University College Cork looked at the disturbance to birds at Great Saltee Island in County Wexford, which is one of the most important seabird colonies in Ireland. The research by Debs Albrook, an MSc student at UCC, looked at the level of disturbance caused by tourists in the summer of 2017. And it showed that many tourists, especially those looking for that perfect photograph of birds on their nests, got too close to the gannets, often to within less than 1 metre. Debs joins us on the line now to tell us more about this. Hello, Debs. How are you today?
Hi there. I'm good, thank you.
So tell us about this research.
There's a lot of controversy about people disturbing the gannets on Great Saltee, so I decided to do my research on and look into more detail about what kind of harm this might be causing and how bad the behaviour actually was there, which led to interesting findings.
What did you find?
Yeah, we found that the nesting success was far, far lower in the disturbed area of the colony than it was at the back. So where the people were going up and approaching the birds, we found that the nesting success plummeted quite dramatically, and all of that area was much lower than the national average of nesting success in gannets.
Now, how important is the Great Saltee for gannets?
Pretty important seabird area. It's a large colony, so of great importance, yeah.
Niall, have you heard about this?
I have, and it's something that's very concerning. We've had quite a few people contacting us in Birdwatch Ireland over the course of the summer this year about this particular problem. Great Saltee is one of only 6 gannet colonies in all of Ireland, so it's of extreme importance, as Debs is saying there. And it has been an issue, this human disturbance at seabird colonies, people trying to get selfies, people trying to get the best shot that they can. It's been a big problem. We've even seen footage on YouTube this year of people flying drones right through gannet colonies. People are then commenting, marvelling how wonderful it is to see all these birds flying up and you know, scattering in front of the camera. Of course, what's happening there is they're leaving their eggs and their chicks behind in a panic, thinking this drone is going to kill them or the photographer is going to harm them. And then, of course, predators like gulls and skuas can then just come in and kill the chicks and take the eggs. It has a big effect on them. The stresses to the parent birds, too, would be absolutely enormous. And it's important to stress that this is completely illegal behaviour under the Wildlife Act. It is a criminal offence to disturb or interfere with the nest of any wild bird. That's what's happening. happening here. So yeah, I'm very concerned.
And Debs, for the benefit of people who've never been on an island, a remote island where there are seabirds nesting, you know, when you say the idea of taking a selfie with a bird in the background, most people think, well, the bird will fly away. Will you describe the lay of the land during the breeding season?
Yeah, so the gannets are all on their nests, and as the layout, anyone that's been to Great Saltie will know, you can just walk up wherever you like. So as you approach the birds, although you might expect they'd fly away, they don't always. They often just sit there because they're protecting their nests, but it doesn't mean that the disturbance isn't there while they've got their eye on you. As Niall was saying, a gull can skip in and steal the egg. Mm. Although it might seem you can just happily take photos and they're not bothered, that isn't the case, as we've shown with the study.
So now that you've discovered that there's a 60% drop, what can you do?
Well, as part of my research, I thought I would put a sign up and see whether that had any impact at all on visitor behaviour. And in fact, it really did. It reduced the impact of people because they didn't go as close. They chose to stand right back, sort of 10 metres away, and look at the colony from a distance. It's kind of shown that it's a lack of knowledge more than anything else. It's not a deliberate disturbance. It's a lack of knowledge. So we put that sign up, and it showed that not only did the visitors behave better, also the gannets were less disturbed, and there was less incidence of eggs being lost and chicks being lost. So actually, since then, there's been a permanent sign put up on Great Saltie, which is a brilliant step forward, and hopefully one that can be repeated on other colonies.
So you'll have to go back next year to see if there's been an impact, if there's been an increase in the numbers, will you?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be ideal. And as there's been some unofficial reports that this year they've done very well because of COVID, there hasn't been as many visitors. So there's been some unofficial reports that the breeding success has been very good this year.
Well, fantastic. Well, it just goes to show you the importance of research now, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It's really great to have those
concrete figures, that scientific evidence to back up what we've long suspected. It does show that these laws are very important. And it shows also that where Ireland falls down is in the enforcement of our laws. We have very good wildlife protection laws in this country. It's just the enforcement just isn't there because the National Parks and Wildlife Service just aren't properly funded to do the work that they do. It's been a big issue. It's very difficult to cover the whole country. I think, of course, when we look at our seabird breeding colonies, they are really the jewel in the crown of Ireland's natural heritage, as far as I'm concerned. These are world-class nature sites. These birds, they're an important part of the whole Atlantic population of this species and many other species as well. We know that the seabirds like guillemots and razorbills and kittiwakes that nest on cliff faces, they tend to be more protected from this kind of disturbance because human beings literally can't get close to them. It would be too dangerous. So you get lots of long lens photography, and that seems to be fine where it's done responsibly. But for birds like gannets and also birds like puffins that would nest on the flatter substrates or in the grassy areas, this does seem to be a big problem. And as Debs was saying there, I think it is about education. I don't believe that any of these photographers want to harm these birds. They're to celebrate them and to enjoy being with them. It's just that they don't realise the stressing effect that they're having on them. Birds show stress in a very different way to the way that humans and other mammals do. Birds tend to stay very still and very quiet when they're under stress, rather than reacting by hissing and snapping and shaking. So you can be stressing the birds and they seem very calm and peaceful. So we humans like to think that they're okay, but it's not necessarily the case. I think when it comes to photography, the ethics of how photographs are taken, it really needs to be considered more. The welfare, for wildlife photography, the welfare of the subject should be of paramount importance above anything else. And that's something, you know, I think more and more photographers are starting to understand. So it's great to get the message out there and to get confirmation of the effects that can be had on birds when the rules aren't followed.
Debs, the last word to you. You're going to send a message out to our listeners. What would you say to them if they're going to visit a seabird colony in the future?
We just need to respect the wildlife. This is their home. This is where they're breeding. This is a very important time of year for them. So just be respectful. It's not worth it for a selfie.
So the message is, and as always, do not interfere with wildlife if you're trying to get a photograph.
Oh, absolutely. In many cases, it's illegal to disturb wildlife, particularly gannets at a nesting colony. I know people don't mean any harm, but that doesn't mean that harm isn't being caused. So it's very important to abide by the wildlife acts that prohibit any kind of disturbance to protected creatures, which includes all wild birds. And I think that, you know, when people are taking photographs, it's important to make sure that it's done so ethically. The welfare of the subject should always be paramount. That's the most important thing of all.
Niall, did you see the story last week in Denmark on Thursday? The government there proposing to cull 15 million mink because of a coronavirus mutation.
I did, yeah. It's a shocking story. I have some very good friends in Denmark, so I texted my friend Suna and asked him about it. Mm-hmm. And he said he was surprised too. He said that he never knew that Denmark had so many mink in fur farms. It seems that they're pretty much the world's largest producer of mink fur. And it's a big story there, because what's happened is that this mutation of the coronavirus has got produced in the minks has reinfected humans. And they worry now in Denmark that this could hinder future vaccination efforts. This may be resistance to the vaccine. So they're taking the very drastic step of culling literally all of the mink in their farms, millions and millions of them.
Now, we've got three farms here, as I understand it, haven't we?
We do, yes. There's just three mink farms left here in Ireland, and I think they don't employ too many people here anymore. It used to be a bigger business than that. But the thing with that is, I think it's 150,000 mink are produced here in Ireland every year. So it's 100 times less than the situation in Denmark, even though we have a comparable human population here. So it's economically not as important here. And it is declining. It's banned actually now in many European countries, including in the UK. It has been for almost 20 years across the UK.
And I know there's a plan to phase out fur farming in Ireland also.
That's right, yes. And I think that that's to be welcomed. We've certainly said the animal welfare issue, of course, is very important. Mink do not take well to being kept in captivity. They're obviously semi-aquatic animals, and when they're not able to swim, it causes them great stress. They also don't like to be together in large groups. In the wild, what a mink would do is it would try to avoid other mink, but in the cages they can't. So there's a lot of stress happens there. But I suppose the biggest problems and perhaps the biggest legacy that comes from the mink farming in Ireland is that so many of these mink either escaped or were released, and there's lots and lots of mink now breeding in the wild in Ireland. They're a non-native invasive species. They're from North America originally, and because of their habits, that they're so good at swimming and at climbing, they've actually decimated lots of animal populations, particularly wild birds that have no defence against them, because the mink can swim out to islands where these birds are nesting, where they otherwise would be secure from other predators. This is a problem in many European countries as well, all across the continent. And on mainland Europe, it's been a problem particularly for the native European mink, which is now a highly endangered species. And that's been pushed out by the American mink. It's sort of bigger and more aggressive and takes over those habitats. So the European mink, which is a natural part of the European ecosystem, is dwindling. It's never been found in Ireland. It's not a native animal to Ireland, but places from France right across through to Russia, there used to be big populations of European mink that are almost all gone. And the American mink seems to be the cause of that.
Now, mink are often mistaken for otter, or should I say otter are often mistaken for mink. So let's finish the programme on a lighter note and something very pleasant. You had a recent encounter with an otter. Let's have a listen.
Hi, Derek. I'm here at Birdwatch Ireland's East Coast Nature Reserve in Newcastle County Wicklow, and I'm keeping my voice down because right now I'm looking out the main hide. It's Monday afternoon, just heads looking at the main hide, and there's a pair of otters right in front of the hide, literally about 5 or 6 metres away from me. It's a mother and her young, and they've just after catching a fish. The mother seemed to catch a fish, there's a bit of a kerfuffle in the water, and then the young one was begging for to be fed. It's really fascinating watching it at such close quarters. What was fascinating as well was that a little egret, that white member of the heron family, as soon as it saw the otters, it immediately flew over to them and started walking around behind them. I think that it was hoping that as they moved to the water, it would stir up some small fish or other things that that then they could grab and make an easy meal out of. But it's certainly some of the best views I ever had of an otter in my life. Really thrilling to watch it. So it just shows you never know what you might see when you go out to see wildlife, or even just take a walk on a lovely clear day like it is today.
So that was at the East Coast Reserve, Niall?
Yes, that was at the East Coast Nature Reserve, Birdwatch Ireland's reserve in Newcastle, County Wicklow. It's within my 5K of my house, so I do my exercise walk down there as often as I can. And it's a great place to go, especially at this time of year, because obviously the wading birds are coming in, we're getting ducks, and very occasionally, if you're lucky, you might see an otter. And I was lucky to see the two of those. Right in front of me, they were just a few metres from the main observation hide there. I was keeping very quiet, so they were completely oblivious to my presence. It was a real treat to see that. And one of the nice things, of course, about otters is that they do tend to keep mink away, because we don't want mink on this nature reserve. And knowing that we have otters there, it means that the otter, they can be mistaken for mink, all right, but otters are much, much bigger and tend to be dominant over mink. So that's good to have them there. It was a lovely day as well. I also saw, just after that, I saw a kingfisher perched on a perch beside there. And one of the most amazing things too with the otters, when they were going around, a little egret, an all-white member of the heron family, it saw the otters and it flew in and started following them around. I think it was hoping to get some of the little fish or other creatures that they may have disturbed as they were swimming, but it's very definitely following around behind the otters as they were going through the water. It was a really amazing sight.
I'll bet it was. I haven't seen an otter in the flesh, so to speak, for a long time myself. Niall, thank you very much indeed. Go back about your business. That's all we have time for today. My thanks also to our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly. Until next time, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.